Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the podcast. Today, we're going to be interviewing attorney Mike Mosher, who won the first case ever to go to trial against the Upjohn company that involved the drug Halcyon in 1992. The case was known as Friedman versus Upjohn in Dallas, Texas. Mr. Mosher represented Bill Freeman, who was a former police officer who had been convicted of first-degree murder of his best friend. In the Upjohn case, Mr. Mosher established that Friedman's action had been caused by the drug Halcyon. Afterwards, the jury awarded his family $1.9 million. Since then, Mr. Mosher has represented plaintiffs in numerous cases all over the United States against doctors and drug companies where the injuries were caused by psychiatric drugs. He has 30 years of experience with courts throughout the entire U.S. Mr. Mosher has tried cases in Georgia, California, Arizona, Texas, and Pennsylvania, and specializes in complex litigation. Mr. Mosher has an extensive background in pharmacokinetics. I have a hard time with that word. The adverse reactions of various drugs, as well as the proper administration of each psychotropic drug, including anxiolytics, for instance, like Xanax, Ativan, and Klonopin, hypnotics, Halcyon, Dalmane, and Ristorol, stimulants like Ritalin, Dexedrine, and Adderall, anticonvulsants like Tegretol, Depakote, and Neurontin, antidepressants, for instance, all the SSRIs, Effexor, and the tricyclic antidepressants, and neuroleptics like Zyprexa, Risperdal, Seroquel, and Abilify. Mr. Mosher has also settled numerous cases against doctors and drug companies involving illnesses and damage due to addiction via the use of Xanax, Klonopin, and other benzodiazepines, as well as injuries resulting from SSRIs. For his full bio, please go to his website, Mosher, M-O-S-H-E-R, Justice, J-U-S-T-I-C-E, Center, C-T-R.com. Please stay tuned after the show for our post-show talk. Thank you. Hi, Mike. I am so happy to have you on today because actually when I put the whole podcast together, doing the one on to sue or not to sue was supposed to be one of the first shows. And here we are doing it, you know, a couple of years later. So I'm very, very glad you've agreed to do this.
Sure. It's a pleasure to be here, Geraldine.
All right. So as you know, people are still being prescribed benzos with no informed consent, no information about tapering. They're still being cold turkeyed and being told withdrawal only lasts a few weeks. So needless to say, many are very angry. They want to sue their doctors, the pharmacies, the hospitals, rehabs, drug companies. So I'm hoping you can answer some of these questions. So what do you look for in a case for you to take it? And what's a deciding factor for you in the end?
Oh, okay. The first number one issue is the statute of limitations.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that happens in benzo cases all too often, and probably in lots of psychiatric drug cases, is some doctor starts somebody on benzos, Xanax, Ativan, Klonopin or something, and then 6 months later, they switch doctors. And then a year later, they switch doctors again. The benzos increase. The doctors that are prescribing the drugs are now years removed from the person who started them on it.
Mm-hmm.
Then you end up in situations where the person comes and says, it realizes that they're dependent or addicted, depending on how you want to phrase this. And then they're going to a doctor saying they'd like to get off, but it's hard. It is not proper, it is not within the standard of care to abruptly terminate someone. So the doctor they're seeing continues to prescribe the benzos. But that's not the doctor who got them addicted. That's not the doctor who blew everything. That doctor is going to have a defense on the standard of care issue that the person came to me addicted. It would be improper for me to just dump him or her. And so you've run out the statute of limitations on the really bad doctor who prescribed this drug for 6 months or a year when it should have been very short term, and who didn't realize that each time the person tried to cut the dose or stop, the anxiety they were experiencing was actually caused by the rebound anxiety from the drug and was not the original underlying anxiety issue.
Right.
And so that's the doctor who's done everything wrong. And maybe the next doctor in line. But the statute of limitations has run on the first doctor.
Okay.
So then you're now looking at a case where even if the last doctor wasn't perfect and there might be a case against him, you sit there with a jury and you have to tell the jury, in essence, the real bad guy was two doctors before this one. And that's just not a good case to bring a lawsuit. That's what, when I look at bringing lawsuits, that's probably the single most damaging thing to a case. And yet that's probably the most common circumstance when somebody calls me up and says, I have a benzo case. How long have you been on them? Oh, 10 years. Anybody who's been on benzos for 10 years, in all probability, the statute is run against the real bad guys.
Okay. So you like when, you know, one doctor just stayed with them, kept prescribing for years. And as you know, many are not even put on for anxiety. They start developing it on the drugs, like in my case. And that's when people might doctor shop because they're like, well, now I have anxiety and now I have stomach issues and it's crazy. So for you, it's the one doctor case is the best always?
One doctor case or one or two doctor cases is typically the best. Now, there are circumstances where you go to the second doctor and tells them they got no problems. It's not the benzos that are causing your problems. You're just crazy or you're just anxious or you've got generalized anxiety disorder. Never mind that you, prior to the time you started on benzos, you had no anxiety. There's so many doctors out there that haven't a clue as to what the drugs they're giving are causing. And one of the things that I see all the time is typically almost no one comes to see me who's only been on benzos. The doctors put them on other things too. You've got a cocktail of bad drugs, which bottom line, which creates some causation problems, but invariably, if you take the doctor's deposition properly, he's going to establish that he has no clue as to what he's doing. I mean, I sort of have a skewed version of doctors because the good doctors I never see. Right. I end up taking depositions of idiots, grossly incompetent doctors. And so it's relatively easy. I think I'm running in circles here. It's relatively easy to hang those doctors, but it's a whole lot easier if they started the process and kept them on.
Right. Okay. So one of the questions, you and I had a quick conversation the other day, because again, I mentioned to you that an attorney had once said to me, oh, you cannot sue if you're on a generic. It has to be a brand because, you know, the, what is it that they have when there's a brand, you know, has run out. So the generics, you can't sue. So what do you have to say? Can you sue if somebody is on a generic versus a brand? Because most people are no longer on brand drugs. They're all on the generics.
It depends on who you're suing. You can't sue the original manufacturer if you're on a generic, even though the original manufacturer is the one who's truly responsible for the label, which is the package insert, which tells what the drug does or does not do. But you can always sue the doctor. Limitation on lawsuits is only against the drug company. And quite frankly, for the most part, I wouldn't bother trying to sue drug companies anymore. Most of the drug companies for most of these drugs have now told the doctors everything they need to do it right. If you look at the label for Xanax, for instance, every single thing it takes to know when you should and should not prescribe this drug is in the label. It goes on for pages and pages. The trouble is that apparently doctors neither read nor care about the label. Now, the label is a matter of federal law contains all the information, the scientific information necessary for the safe and effective use of the drug. If a doctor doesn't know what's in the label and he misprescribes that drug or does a bad job with you, he has violated the standard of care almost as a matter of law. And so when you get the situation where you've been injured by a drug and all the information necessary to not do that to you is in the label, you have no lawsuit against the drug company, only the doctor.
Okay. So here's a question, because everybody that wants to sue, they haven't worked, they've been harmed. So you, years ago, when you did my case, it was on a contingency basis. So what is the difference between contingency, or if somebody has to pay out of pocket? Because I know you were saying you no longer do contingency, correct? And you can talk about that. So how do we get lawyers to listen and take these cases?
Well, the general principle that I'm not doing contingency work anymore is, if you came with the right case, I'd still do it. But okay, the right case in that circumstance is rare. But if I'm going to go out and risk a lot of time and effort, what I've done in the past is I've said, okay, a fixed fee of X, unless we go to trial, and then another $15,000 for the trial. Mm-hmm. So that, well, just by way of example, I've got a case that I'm doing, that I've done, and I charged the person $35,000 up front and another $15,000 for the trial. If I was billing at my standard hourly rate, it's probably a $250,000 case so far.
Wow.
But the person also paid the expert fees. And so I'm happy to do that in a case, because these people have been terribly injured. And if I don't, and they can't find a lawyer to do it, they get no satisfaction whatsoever. The doctor doesn't even know he's an incompetent.
Right.
So I'm willing to
bring Mike, is it?
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, as you're talking, I'm thinking, do you consult with, because you've done benzo cases, that's how I was given your name years ago. I mean, we're talking, because I said to you earlier, I found a memo from November of 2000, where I'm sending you and Dr. Bregan a fax. And do you consult with other lawyers, since you've done benzo cases, to help them learn? Is that something that
yes,
you do?
Yes, that is something I do do. I do do that, okay. And I'm happy to do that. There's a case that I'm considering taking on as a consultant, basically to help the other lawyer, to prepare him for depositions. I can draft the deposition. One of the things I've learned over the years is how to essentially get the proof of your case out of the doctor's own mouth. And what you do is the essential thing is, doctor, do you believe that it is a breach of the standard of care to needlessly endanger the health and safety of the patient? Every doctor says yes. Hmm. Doctor, do you believe that the standard of care requires you to know the essential scientific information necessary for the safe and effective use of the drug? Yes, yes, of course. And then you take that doctor and you establish that he hasn't a clue about the essential scientific information necessary for the safe and effective use of the drug, that he knows nothing about the bloody drug. And by the time the deposition is over, he has virtually agreed that he breached the standard of care, and the only issue of is damages and causation. There's still always causation. In other words, mm-hmm. were these problems caused by the drug, or, as every defense expert will say, this person had this condition before, this person had the condition after, it was all due to the condition and not the drugs. But if you get that deposition right, you can use that deposition at trial, and you videotape it, and you play it for the jury, and the jury understands this doctor is confessing that he's incompetent. Mm-hmm. And then the defense is limited to causation and damages. And it takes, when once you're able to do that, and I can help any attorney do that. Okay. You can't save a case if the jury hates the client. But most of the time, the jury, you work with your client so they don't, you know, sometimes people are just, they're so angry. They're so upset. And they've been harmed so much that when they get on the witness stand, that anger comes through. And for better or worse, juries don't like it. So you've got to work with your client so you can tone that back so the client can get on the witness stand and do a good job as a witness. And if they can do that, and if you've nailed that doctor, you're going to get a verdict if you go to trial. And if you have got that circumstance set up, you don't have to go to trial.
Right. Do you feel you've settled more cases for benzos versus going to trial? Because
oh,
it's,
yes.
You know, either the doctors. Okay, so you have.
I only go to trial the basic rule is I have to go to trial when the defense thinks it can't lose. Does that make sense? The defense thinks it can't lose. I go to trial. And the truth is, sometimes the defense is right. Sometimes, no matter what I do on those kinds of cases, I can't win it anyway. Right. But most of the time, you settle the case. And a nice thing about settling is there's no appeals. You get a check and you go home. The client's better off. Everybody's better off. I have yet to win a case that I didn't also have to defend that verdict on appeal.
Okay. All right.
And that takes another year or two.
Well, that was going to be one of my questions. How long can the process take? So I guess that's hard to answer. It's going to depend on, you know, whether the doctor's willing to settle.
Right. I have resolved cases in a year to a year and a half. And I have a case right now that's been ongoing for almost 10 years.
Yeah. Okay. So that's a tough question to answer. And people need to know that.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if you're aware, you know, because, you know, we're in touch from time to time, but I don't know if you're aware that here in Massachusetts that we have filed for legislation 4 times. We just did the last one. My son, Garrett, works in at the Massachusetts State House. So we're not asking for much. We're looking for informed consent, short-term reason, short-term prescription, long-term users to be educated and not forced off their benzos. They get to make the decision to taper, and a symptom-guided taper. You know, that there aren't set guidelines, which would be horrific. Did you know we were doing that? And what are your thoughts about legislation? I mean, I wish we wouldn't have to do legislation. The doctor should be, like, taking care of this, you know?
What do I think about legislation? I think that bill sounds wonderful. And the nice thing about it is if you ever get one state to pass it, you're going to get other states to pass it. You're also going to have doctors. Every medical continuing legal education for doctors is going to say, look what they're doing in Massachusetts. For God's sake, don't screw it up here.
Right.
Doctors will actually be educated. If you can get that done in one state, every doctor will suddenly take a second look at benzos.
Right. Now, there are other states filing. I believe New Jersey, I believe Connecticut, I think Hawaii. I mean, we've all been fighting for this for years. Now, the first year we did it, you know, as my son explained, you know, we probably weren't going to make it the first time. Second time, we were hopeful. Nothing happened. You know, it was thrown up. But the third time, we actually, Garrett, what happened during that? We were... it was going to go a little bit further, but then COVID happened. So, right. It died in committee. All right. So now he's filed, you know, the time was up. He's filed again, he and his boss. And, you know, who knows, you know, what's going to happen this fourth time. But every time we go, we're up against the Massachusetts doctors that come in, Mass Medical goes against it. And they come back each year and, you know, they're saying benzos are easier than, aspirin, you know, safer than aspirin, easier than caffeine to get off. And you think, are you
Wait a second.
Listening
are they
to
really
us?
Still saying that?
Yes, but here's the other thing. When I'm usually the first one that gets to speak, and they've been asked every year by the committee to stay and listen to all of us that have shown up that are harmed, and every year they walk out. They don't even listen to us. They don't want to hear it, you know?
I don't see how, when you look just at the label for Xanax, the label for Xanax says 10 to 15%, my quote may be slightly off, of the people who use this drug for long term will never get off. That's right there in the Upwell, it's Pfizer now, approved label. How can you possibly say it's easy to get off when that's staring you in the face?
Well, yeah. And the other thing is, one of them that teaches at Harvard, he runs a seminar every year saying, here they go again about benzos. And he makes fun, basically, of all of us trying to do something. I mean, there's so many more articles. The FDA black box warning has come out. There are more organizations starting. They're just not listening. I don't understand it. You know, there's more books, more podcasts, more everything, and I don't get it. So now here's one thing I wanted to mention to you. Since COVID, so many have ended up on psychiatric drugs, especially benzos. And last I heard, benzo prescriptions were up 34%. And that was at the beginning of the pandemic. So I did a podcast with somebody that had been prescribed a benzo, and he was only on it 2 weeks, and he was so ill from it. And then came, of course, the multiple drugging. Then he finally found a doctor, and then it took months to taper off. He's still not 100%. I do a recap. I did a recap recently to see how he's doing. But we are already seeing people in the support groups who've sought help. They were prescribed medication instead of therapy. Do you see with the pandemic more sick people? Are you being contacted already in such a short time?
No.
Because they're shocked.
No.
They're sick. Not yet.
The
it's coming.
The pandemic hasn't changed my practice other than I don't go to trial on it. See, I'm not just a benzo lawyer. In fact, it's a very, very small part of my practice anymore.
Right.
I do criminal law, a lot of criminal work, because it's nice, straightforward. You go to trial, you win a case, or you lose a case, or you plead somebody. And I enjoy trying cases. And criminal trials, a week is a long criminal trial. Mm-hmm. A week is a short benzo trial. And when you're, if you have a big firm, a week or two trial isn't that big a deal. Mm-hmm. But when you're a sole practitioner, a week trial, when you got to take every witness on direct and cross, prepare every witness, it's a lot of bloody work. You don't sleep much during that time.
Right.
So, bottom line is, it's such a small part of my practice. And I am in Paris, Texas. So if I'm getting a benzo case, it's because somebody's found me from somewhere else in the country besides Paris, Texas.
Oh, yeah, I know. People are always looking. So, you know, one of the questions years ago, and now that we have all these support groups and people know they're sick and they're too sick to sue, but there was something about data discovery. The date you discover, right, the date you discover the drug is what made you sick. So if somebody's in one of these support groups for years, and in their state it could be, you know, like 2 years, or Massachusetts is 3 years, or somebody else could be 1 year, right then they shouldn't even consider suing, right? If they have to check their state. I mean, tell me if I'm saying this
the day you join a support group, it's going to be impossible to argue you didn't know the cause of your injuries.
Right.
So California is 1 year. Texas is 2 years. New York is 2.5 years. 3 years is an unusually large, long time. No, if you've been in a support group for several years, don't worry about suing. Find something else. Get yourself an exercise bike and exercise every single day.
Right. That's kind of why we're doing this. Right.
Yeah.
We are trying to do this because so many are angry. And it's like, I think it's good to do something with your anger because, you know, but it's like, let's settle this now today on this podcast. those that need to let it go so they no longer have that anger and take that anger and, you know, you could put it into helping the support groups or doing something and, you know, whatever. So I'm glad we cleared that up. So if they are in the support groups, that data discovery is important. When they knew finally, even though doctors told them for years, it's not the drugs.
It's not finally. Here's the test in most jurisdictions is when a reasonable person would be on notice to start investigating whether or not there was a negligent cause for their injuries. So it might be 6 months before you entered the support group, depending on the particular circumstances. But it's going to be a fuzzy test, but it's not when you finally discovered. It's when you first were on, quote, what they call in most jurisdictions, inquiry notice. When you were on notice, there was time to start investigating whether or not negligence was the cause of your injuries.
Okay. All right. Hopefully that will clear it up for people. Because I know with Mayan, it was this constant.
It's vague.
It's
that is a very vague standard.
All right. So, you know, you've been doing this for a long time. And it was a pharmacist years ago that asked me to sue. You know, he said that the only way to get doctors to pay attention and stop overprescribing benzos and understand how difficult they were to get off, you know, was to sue. So in all these years, do you see any changes happening with, I know this isn't a huge part of your practice. Do you see any changes or the cases that people come to you? It's still the same thing.
The cases that people come to me are the same thing. However, I have noticed in the real world that there are a lot more doctors out there who are aware of how bad benzos are.
Okay.
But they're not the ones that you have to sue.
Right.
Those guys have figured it out. Nobody's going to sue them. The people that come to me are in that group of doctors that never met a drug they didn't like.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we see them at the Massachusetts State House. Shocking that they do not in any way have any sympathy for anybody that's there. It's awful. In fact, one even brought a patient with him to show how long he's had his patient on Xanax and how he can even take little vacations from them and it doesn't bother him at all. It was absolutely insane to even witness that.
It was. You know, I'll tell you what's interesting, though, is I took the deposition of, I believe he was the head of Harvard Medical School at the time. He was actually a defense expert. And I had some time to talk to him before the deposition and after the deposition. And while he didn't believe that that particular case merited a lawsuit, he didn't trust drug companies, and he didn't like the drugs, those particular drugs we were suing on. But I can't remember his name now. It was years ago. And he may not even be at Harvard anymore. I don't know. But bottom line is, there are some people out there who have enough sense not to trust drug companies. But those people aren't being hired by drug companies. The drug companies are hiring the ones they hire the ones in the universities with big names who will do what they want. But here's something else to remember if you get into a lawsuit with them, is that the guys who do the drug studies at big hospitals don't necessarily really know anything about the drugs, because the drug studies they're administering were designed in-house by the drug company, approved by the FDA for the exact design and nothing else. And the doctor who's doing that drug study at a university, it's double-blinded if he's doing it right. He doesn't know who's on the drug and who's not. He's following a simple protocol. In the words of an expert I once had, a nurse could do it. They aren't doing anything genius-like. What's more, they don't see the results. They don't break the code and do the examination. They send it back to the drug company. And then the drug company prepares a report and an analysis and writes it, and they sign it. So they get their name on a study that's published somewhere, but they don't really know what the drug did or didn't do. They're simply taking the drug company's word for it. And if any doctor who's representing you if any lawyer who's representing you is cross-examining one of those doctors, it's worth thinking about that doctor who claims to know the drug because he did a study or he did a series of studies can be dissected because he doesn't really know anything about the drug based on the study he did. All he knows is the report the drug company wrote up.
That's pretty interesting and sad at the same time.
Oh, it is. It is. And of course, the drug companies want to be able to say, oh, our studies were for Harvard or MIT or, all these big, big major institutions. But they're not giving those guys anything to actually... The mere fact that you did a study means you didn't know what was really going on because you were given a protocol that you were not allowed to vary from. And you're basically just checking for side effects. And you don't even know whether the reaction you're seeing is from the placebo, the comparator drug, or the live drug. Because unless you break the code, which you're not supposed to do, if you're breaking the code, you're cheating.
Right.
By the way, if anybody's interested, if a doctor wants to cheat and break the code, it's very easy. You open the bottle, you break open the capsule. If there's a pill inside, it's probably the live drug. If it's powdered sugar, it's the placebo. And then you can then record what is or what is not. And there are doctors who are famous for doing exactly that, so they could give the drug companies exactly the results they wanted. And those people made their living doing drug studies because every drug company knew they were breaking the code to ensure that the drug came out and got a clean bill of health.
Mike, you're a wealth of information. So, Mike, before we go, is there anything, that you could say to somebody right now who is angry, who's considering suing, to either just calm them down, do it, don't do it, because it does take a lot.
Yeah, it does. Here's the best thing, the best advice I can give anybody who's filing suit. File the suit if somebody will take it for you, and then get on with your life. Do what's necessary for the suit, but don't make it your life. Get on with your life, and if it pays off, treat it like you won the lottery. Do not put your life on hold for a lawsuit against a doctor or a drug company. You get on and you do something with your life and you get over this and you go forward. And if you happen to win the lawsuit, great, you got a windfall. But don't live for it, and for God's sake, don't die for it.
Right. Right. I am so glad that we got to talk to you today. You gave us some very good information. And I think this will help a lot of people as they hear it, Mike. And I really want to thank you for your time.
You're welcome, Geraldine. It's a pleasure to talk to you again.
All right. Thanks, Mike.
Bye-bye. Bye.
All right, Garrett, we just finished the podcast with Mike Mosher. I thought it was very informative because this is something for years that you see around the support groups and people asking for an attorney, can I sue? So I know this was one of the original podcasts we wanted to do, and we just didn't get to it till now. So what did you think of it, seeing how you're a lawyer? And I'm going to have to apologize because you had some questions, and I didn't turn it over to you to ask the questions you wanted to ask.
Yeah, I think the thing that stuck out to me the most that he said, basically how quickly people need to figure out that something's gone wrong with them, because the reasonable person standard, I think, kicks in a lot sooner than people realize. So, people get on boards or whatever it may be, and they start to figure out, the symptoms that I'm feeling are potentially because of this drug that I'm on.
Mm-hmm.
And, they have no idea that, that potentially starts the clock on the reasonable person. And then a year or two go by pretty quickly, and depending on what state you're in, it may or may not lock you out of being able to sue the doctor.
Right.
So that's kind of a tough hurdle for a lot of people, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. So it's good that people hear that, because maybe you're very early on in finding all this stuff, and just right. hearing that, like, it gets you making the phone calls you need to make right away if you do feel like you're somebody who should be suing.
Right. And but he's saying, you know, it's better if there's just one doctor involved. Sometimes when you've gone doctor to doctor, because people don't know for years that it's the drugs making them sick and they've been multi-drugged. He's right there. You know, people are always, they're going to add in an antidepressant or an antipsychotic. And maybe it was the original benzo because you went for a muscle neck, you know, a problem with your neck, or it was after surgery. I mean, it's not always anxiety. That's, I think one time when we went into the state house, I had a 3-page list of all the reasons people were put on. Anxiety was not the major one. There were 3 pages of reasons. It was crazy.
Yeah. I think, too, and we didn't get to talk to him about that because, you know, we didn't get into, you know, more legal stuff. But he did talk about causation and standards of care. Mm-hmm. And I think, to me, I would have been interested to hear what he had to say about causation and proving that, because you could see in certain situations where, you know, whether it's the plaintiff or it's the defense, they're going to be able to offer an expert that says, well, this is a person that's always been sick. They were sick on the drugs. They're going to be sick after. Mm-hmm. And then somebody on the other side who says, so it'd be interesting to see, you know, what is it in the case law that you're able to get over the hurdle of causation? And then, you know, with standard of care, you mentioned it when we were talking about, you know, doctors that are as high in their field as they can get, they come and they will testify to the fact that this is the standard of care. So, it, you know, he's an attorney that has seen these cases in a multitude of states. I'd be curious to see if the standard is different from, you know, if you're here in Massachusetts or you're trying a case in Texas or you're trying a case in California. Is there a standard of care? Like, is there a case law and is it settled? And he just needs to apply it, or is he, you know, is he dealing with it on a state-by-state basis, depending on, you know, medical boards or whatever it is that's going on there?
Well, I think there was a case I brought up to you that, and again, when people think it's very hard to sue, I think, to find an attorney, and you really want to do it contingency. You don't want to pay out of pocket. People have already, you know, they're sick, they've been out of work, they've lost a lot. So personally, I would not pay any money to try to sue unless you find a lawyer that will do it contingency, where you might just have to pay for expert fees or something like that. But a case here where I think I had talked to you about it, we were trying to help this person find an attorney. In all my years, I had never heard of such a high dose. And basically the hospital saying it was standard of care. Like, you have got to be kidding me, you know? So yeah, is that how they get out of everything? Standard of care?
Yeah. So, I mean, to me, that's why these things take so long. It's because there probably is no, you know, case law saying, well, this is the standard of care when it comes to a doctor and when it comes to a benzodiazepine. And so you can't, it's not as simple as opening the book and applying the rule to whatever's mm-hmm. going on in a certain situation. But yeah, you know, interesting guy. And like you said, I can imagine how difficult it would be for people to find an attorney because of how long these cases take to try. Mm-hmm. And if you are not somebody who is knowledgeable in what's going on with these kind of drugs, why would you spend so much time on a case like this? So I can imagine, you know, it's a difficult thing, not only finding an attorney, but, you know, educating them on your situation and what's going on kind right. of on a macro level with it.
So, you know, take your anger. You got to do something with it. Anger is not good, but if you can take it and do something good with it, then you've done something right. You know, do you go back to the doctor at some point when you're well and educate them? You know, there's been a lot of harm. I mean, I have seen a lot of harm over the years. Even look at what happened to me. I lost the right to have more children. I lost my career. All because, and for all those years I was on it, I asked every doctor, is it the Ativan? You know, oh, no, we give it out like candy. It's harmless, non-addictive. Mm-hmm. If I heard that one more time, you know, and yet look at all the information that's been available. These doctors are not paying attention to. And yet now we know that there are some wonderful doctors out there, and they do realize, and they are trying to help people. So I am not criticizing doctors in general. You know, it takes years to change a mindset.
Yeah, and like you said, there's a lot of good doctors, too.
A lot of wonderful
doctors.
You're
dealing with, not everybody graduates at the top of their class, and not everybody is, you know, this wonderful, yeah, caring doctor. Some of them aren't, and some, yeah, of them. Yeah. But, you know, a thing that you bring up is, you know, something that I'd be curious to see what Mike has to say about it with all the cases that he's tried. Because he said in the interview that, you know, he settles more than he would take to trial, which, right, makes sense.
Right.
But, you know, even with us, as we do the legislation or, you know, whatever bill it is that I'm working on, emotion is a big part of it. And especially when it's something that affects somebody's life. And when you're dealing with these kind of trials, you're dealing with people that have lost big chunks of their lives, you know, whether it's the years, whether it's a job, whether it's, you know, wife, girlfriend, boyfriend, whatever it is. And the money's not good enough. Mm-hmm. You know, what would, you know, like, whatever the number is that, would that fill the hole that, you know, this thing has created in your life?
Right.
No. And you are never going to get any sort of satisfaction that would make you feel whole again. So I think that there's a problem with, you know, whether or not people can actually get justice for this kind of thing.
Right.
And they have to realize the money is as good as you're going to get, because you're never going to get an apology.
So, right. There was somebody that I talked to years ago. They were suing the doctor, a hospital, and I think two pharmacies, if I remember right. And, you know, I remember him saying he thought he'd have enough to buy a house and a car. And he said, in the end, he said he didn't even get enough to buy a car. So you have to weigh it out, you know, weigh out everything that you're going to go through emotionally. And he gave some great advice. And if you're going to do it, you know, do it, get on with your life. If you, yeah, win, great. But I don't think anybody should invest a lot of money in it, because you, unless you know you are 100% winnable, you know, then you go for it.
Yeah. That, the, I mean, when he mentioned the number of the payment that he took up front for that case, it's like, there's not a lot of people that could afford to do that.
Right. And most of them are on disability or not working at all. Families are taking care of them, or they're just barely getting by. It's, you know, I mean, we've seen a lot, because you've met a lot of people in at the State House. So it's, yeah. So it's, and again, it's finding the attorneys. Very, very hard, you know. All right. Anything else you want to add? Any updates? Anything happening?
Updates with the legislation?
Well, yeah, I think the last time we know, it's just kind of sitting there for a while. Oh, are people, anybody from Massachusetts that's listening, you know, we're trying Holly Hardman with her invisibletogether.org. She's been sending out stuff. Sonia Stiblo has been sending out letters to all the Massachusetts people to please contact your representatives and your senators. You can go to Holly's website at invisibletogether.org. You can go right there and just send a quick message, you know, an email to your rep and senator, and ask them to support an act relative to benzodiazepines and non-benzodiazepine hypnotics.
Yeah.
And do we, is it important to give the number for it? The
no, because you know, the number will change soon.
Right.
For the most part, bills haven't been pushed to committees yet.
Mm-hmm.
So everything kind of has a docket number right now.
Right. And we've got time. So please, you know, you know, even if you're not from Massachusetts, but you know people here, because, you know, we only have so many people on the list, contact them, ask them to please go to invisibletogether.org, or, you know, get a hold of Sonia Stiblo at I think it's Sonia at benzoinfo.com, and, you know, give her your name and let her have your email and get on the list for Massachusetts people. And same with Holly, you know, get your email to her so that they've got lists when we're trying to get information out to Massachusetts people. All right. I think it was a great show and very informative. And I want to thank you all for listening. This means a lot. The number of people listening is growing, and we're getting information out there. Thank you very much.